You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where Mattel's new Barbie is still unacceptable because it's not transgender or a midget. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and if you really think this is a social justice podcast, I'm going to warn you to turn this off right now because this is nowhere close to a social justice podcast. It's actually an anti-social justice podcast. So if you are anti-social justice, please tell a friend this is the place to be. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, just freshly back from Boston. Had a great time out there at a conference, AWS reInvent. I gave a talk out there. It went really well. It's now on YouTube, and we open sourced a project. So a lot of really cool stuff. It was perfect weather out there, Justin. It was like 76 degrees. In the evening, a little bit of like mist kind of rolled in, cooled down everything a little bit. So every day I was out there, I walked about a mile from the hotel to the conference center, just enjoying basically going from sort of the central Boston to the convention center. And it was just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, this is the time of year to go to Boston. I mean, if you want to see how amazing of a city that Boston is, you want to go in the summer. I mean, maybe late summer, early fall, if you want to see the foliage and catch a Patriots game and a Red Sox game, that might be, or and the Celtics are playing at that point too. So maybe a couple months from now. But I would say from this time until early fall is the time to go to Boston or New England.
Yeah, it was. I definitely recommend it. Though I have to tell you, the most Boston thing happened to me as soon as I got in my Lyft from the airport. We were starting to wind our way out, and there were these group of folks like just blatantly, blindly jaywalking in front of traffic, and a taxi cab driver ahead of us gave them a quick honk. And immediately the person turned to the taxi and started swearing incessantly at it in a Bostonian accent. It was hilarious. I was like, oh, Boston hasn't changed.
Yeah, but that's really interesting too, because my experience in Boston is if you're nice to people, that they'll actually be courteous and nice to you, unlike out here in California.
Oh, so, I think that's absolutely true. But I think just that attitude and accent, like right away, like my first interaction with, well, not interaction, but observation after getting into the city, I thought it was pretty Bostonian.
Yeah, well, it's 100% is because you notice the problem with Boston is there are those people that act like they're out here in California and they try and be dicks to the Boston people, but the Boston people are just dicks back to them. Because as I was saying, it's like a, you know, there's a mutual understanding that if you're nice, we'll be nice, but if you're dicks, we'll be dicks. So you get to experience the dick part of it firsthand.
Oh, baby.
And actually, Daniel is in New England right now. He is in Providence attending a Catholic wedding, which is one of the most New England things you can do in New England. So he won't be joining us this week. Thought you might have something to say about that, William. I guess
well,
not. Instead, we're going to have
I
you
think
take...
It's... I am still privileged in some way.
So I think that's really what I have to say about it.
That's what I was waiting for. I knew you had something planned, William. And I'm interested to hear what you have planned in the news because you're going to be taking over for Daniel this week. So let's head into it in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
And this week, the news, as always, is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon. And you too can join in supporting our channel and bringing awesome news. So first up, we have some breaking news. This is literally happening this weekend. Antifa mob viciously assaults journalist Andy Ngo at Portland rally. Masked activists attack the Colette editor with fists and milkshakes, sending him to the emergency room. Andy Ngo, a photojournalist and editor at Colette, landed in the emergency room after a mob of Antifa activists attacked him on the streets of Portland during a Saturday afternoon demonstration. The assailants wore black clothing and masks and were engaged in a counter-protest against several right-wing groups, including the Proud Boys. Ngo is a well-known chronicler of Antifa activity and has criticized their illiberal tactics on Fox News. He attended the protest in this capacity, as a journalist covering a notable public event. According to Ngo, his attacker stole his camera equipment, but video footage recorded by another journalist, the Oregonian's Jim Ryan, clearly shows an Antifa activist punching Ngo in the face. Others threw milkshakes at him. So a couple of updates from Twitter. As I said, this is a breaking story. Apparently, the Antifa activists were mixing basically cement and putting that in their milkshakes, which, if you guys don't know, that makes for very serious chemical burns that are not easily noticed, especially if it gets into your shoes or on your clothing. So those were the milkshakes they were throwing. They actually have video of people mixing up these cement milkshakes. And also, unfortunately, overnight, Andy's been admitted to the hospital. He has a brain hemorrhage. Things look very serious right now. So Justin, this one, of course, hits close to home to us. This isn't the first time we've covered Antifa events. What do you think about this latest escalation of chemical warfare?
Well, escalation, that was exactly the word that I was thinking of. So I'm glad you went there and started with that, because how are we, and I'm using that very much in the sense of we're in this together. Right. I mean, you know, I'm all about individualism. I know you're all about individualism. But there's a certain point where we who share values have to stand up and have to fight back and stand up for what's right and set a line. And how have we let it get to this point? And I say we as the institutions of our country are supposed to represent us, the governed. And when we're looking at the police and we're looking at the government, how have they, those institutions that are supposed to be us, let it get to this point that these people who are obviously doing shady things, right? You don't wear masks. You don't get mad at people for having cameras. You don't use milkshakes to cover up the fact that you're mixing in concrete and pouring that on people.
It's basically an acid attack. I mean, in this case, it's a base, but it's a
hidden acid attack.
Yeah.
Look, dude, in the Middle East, right, when they throw acid on women, it's fucking horrific. But you know they're doing it. They're not hiding it. They believe that they have the moral justification on their side when they're doing that. Now, I'm not defending them, but the point I'm making is they have such moral surety that they don't hide it. It's not like they mix acid in with, like, Mountain Dew and throw it on women. Right. Here, they are doing these things because they know what they are doing is wrong in Antifa, but they're doing it in a way that they can get away with it, and no one's holding them responsible. I don't understand. Isn't one of the legitimate uses of government the police?
And isn't this not in Portland? I mean, in Portland, the police's job is to stand by and tweet about these cement milkshakes, but not actually arrest anyone.
Okay, and that's the problem. Haven't we lost Portland? Isn't Portland no longer free?
It's the home of homeless and Antifa. I mean, if we... I don't know what else to say. I mean, why would anyone want to go or live there?
People try to tell me it has good pizza and donuts in Portland, but I'm like...
Is there cement mixed with those donuts?
Right. I mean, in the Boston cream donuts, is there cement mixed in with the cream in Portland donuts? I mean, if you want donuts, go to New England. If you want pizza, go to New York City. Like, why would you go to Portland with the weather being terrible? Like, here's another question for you, William, about the balance between federal and state powers. And maybe we would need Daniel this week to answer this. But is this a national crisis at this point that the federal government would have a legitimate case for stepping in and restoring order to this city? I mean, why is a counter protest mean violence nowadays? If you want to have two groups of people yelling at each other, that's fine. But also, when did this whole idea of a counter protest come to be? If somebody is protesting against what I believe in, I'm not going to go out there and yell at them while they're speaking. I'm going to give them their time to speak. I mean, isn't that a lack of maturity? Isn't this, maybe this is a demonstration of how infantile we've all become with, you know, relativism and safe spaces and everything? Because if you're in a fight with someone and they're talking about what they have problems with, you don't just yell back at them at the problems you have. You give them space and time to be heard and to deal with and say what they have to say, and then that's processed, and then maybe the next day you bring up your gripes. The idea that you're even just going to go out there and yell at them, I don't even know if I agree with that as a counter-protest, but then you take the idea of a counter-protest and you add violence to it? When did this happen? When did this become a thing? That counter-protest,
well, I can tell you, we know the answer to when this became a thing. When we started equating words with violence. I mean,
yes.
Remember, the Carlos Monza, that asshole Vox editor that started the latest YouTube adpocalypse, he was tweeting about milkshake them all, humiliate them, blah, blah, blah. Again, there's no distinction, right, between words and actions. Actually throwing a milkshake is the same thing as speaking words. And now, well, is he still advocating milkshaking them all the fascists, especially with the new chemical-enhanced versions of milkshakes? I mean, violence is violence, right? Like, words are words. And until we get this distinction back in our heads, I don't see an end to this.
Well, right, you're 100%. And I mean, more fundamentally, it goes back to the idea that we just mislabel anyone that disagrees with us. And that gives us reason to attack them.
It's, I mean, not it's just mislabel, it's dehumanize, right?
Yeah, the dehumanizing goes along with the mislabeling. Yeah. They have certain buzzwords that have become these dehumanizing words. I mean,
yeah, Nazi, a gay Asian independent journalist is obviously a white nationalist.
Right, because he was on Fox News.
And he covered the Proud Boys. Like, even this article in Reason Magazine, I think, incorrectly framed it because he covers extremist events, period, right? Like, he's been to Proud Boy events, he's been to Antifa events, he's been to all these things, and he covers them as objectively as he can, and there lies the problem, right? He points out the Antifa violence when it happens, and that's not acceptable. I mean, because throwing milkshakes is not violence, right? Carlos Monza tells us.
I mean, throwing milkshakes is definitely violence, but now that, I mean, I'm glad you told me this thing about the concrete. I didn't know this before the show. I want to be clear, throwing anything at someone is violence, even if there's nothing in it, right? Even if you're throwing milkshakes at people, that's still violence, especially with the intent of, you know, shaming and harming this person. I mean, let's look at the shame scene in Game of Thrones, right? Isn't that violence when they were throwing things at her, even if they were just throwing fruits at her?
Yeah, weren't those definitely.
Fruits being thrown violently, right. So even if you're throwing food at someone, it's still violence. But the idea that they're mixing concrete in with this, I'm dumbfounded. I'm at a loss for words because I don't understand how any mayor, any police officer, police commissioner can be okay with those people walking the streets. You are literally not doing your job if you know there are people out there mixing milkshakes with concrete and throwing them on people. That is that dumbfounds me. We're not talking about Glee here, right? In Glee, they had milkshakes thrown on people, right? That was like one of the plot points. We're not talking about that. They're not like, this isn't like a Glee reference. Ha ha, this is cutesy. This is literally, as you said, literally a chemical attack, and you're okay with that? I don't even care what beliefs this Andy No guy has, right? I mean, as you pointed out, he doesn't have any bad beliefs. They've just labeled him as a white supremacist, even though he's a gay Asian independent journalist. None of that makes any sense. But It doesn't matter. If he's not harming people, let's just leave it at that. You shouldn't be throwing milkshakes on him. He's just walking in a crowd.
Yeah, well, it's like I said, this is breaking. I'm sure we'll have an update next week, and thoughts out to Andy, and hopefully a speedy recovery. But difficult transition.
Isn't it more the psychological stuff to be worried about? I mean, I saw the pictures and stuff, and yeah, he got beat up, and no one should ever get beat up like that. But isn't the concern here more the psychological? Because now they're doing this to try and silence him.
Yeah,
basically they don't want him out there covering them anymore, so they want to scare him into not going out there and covering him. Because let me ask you, wouldn't it be rational to say, fuck that, I'm not going to go out there and cover them anymore? It's not worth the psychological and physical damage.
Or the permanent damage in the case of brain injury. I mean, that's the goal, right? Like, this is someone who actually does a great job covering this. I think Tim Pool has historically also covered Antifa events, especially at the beginning of the Occupy Wall Street, and covered a lot of the violence in a very objective fashion there. And even Tim Pool is nervous about covering Antifa. He's been targeted specifically on Twitter by Antifa, just like Andy was. I mean, and just one last thing before we move from this story. You have a ton of blue check marks on Twitter talking about how Andy was only going into this situation to play the victim. Basically projecting, right? Because that's what they would do. Despite his history of covering these kinds of extremist groups on both sides during their protests, and all of a sudden you see a lot of these tweets getting deleted now that he's actually been injured, and they have it on video, and even the initial pictures, some of these blue check marks were just kind of making fun of him and saying, kind of celebrating the fact that he was attacked, and you see some of them silently deleting their tweets. But this excuse for Antifa violence is just going to continue by the sort of social justice left.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is more example, what you just said are more examples of the fact that they have to do things in a duplicitous way. Everything's hidden, right? When people need to hide things, then there's a problem. And the fact that journalists are all secretly deleting their tweets and pretending that this never happened, that they never said those things, that tells you what they think about what they're saying as they're saying it.
Well, speaking of people who don't think about what they're saying as they're saying it, the Democrat debate night 2 viewership hits an all-time debate high for party of FDR, JFK, and HRC. For some reason, there's an update here that says, looks like the viewership estimates for the second Democratic debate were as conservative as frontrunner Joe Biden, with 18.1 million tuning in to see Kamala Harris school the former VP. The simulcast across NBC, MSNBC, and Telemundo is officially the most watched debate, blah, 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 blah. So, topping the previous high of a CNN-hosted Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders-led Yak Fest of October 2015 by 2.6 million, last night's debate also had 9 million viewers and 14 million video views across all platforms, such as NBC News, MSNBC, Telemundo, NBC News Now on OTT devices, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, which means CNN better get its engines roaring for the next set of Dems debates that is hosted in Motor City next month. So, Justin, does this mean that the Democrats are full of life and vigor going into the presidential election?
I mean, I'm not sure what the hell is going on. Hopefully people are just witnessing the train wreck. Hopefully everyone is just witnessing the farce. All I can think of is everyone is a sucker. Okay, this seems to me like market testing for who could possibly beat Trump. It seems like they're throwing a lot of fucking people on stage. They're seeing how people are reacting. They're reading the tweets. They're on the social media. They're testing out with their demographic and seeing who their demographic responds to, and then that's the person they're going to push. This all seems like market testing for the Democratic Party, and it seems like everyone has been buying into it. If anything, this shows how successful the news media has been, the left has been, to marketing to their base over the past 2.5 years. The idea that they've riled their base up so much that they're all watching this. But then, of course, aren't there a lot of people on the right sort of hate watching this or watching this out of a morbid curiosity? So if anything, it shows the way everyone is suckers for this political cycle and this collectivist game that they've asked us to buy into. I mean, I didn't watch this at all. Did you watch this at all, William?
I didn't watch it at all. No. And I was trying to look it up real fast. Maybe you can look it up while I chat. But is this more people than voted in the last midterm that actually watched this debate? I think it might be. So, yeah, apparently Trump also enjoyed it. He tweeted out, "I am in Japan at the G20 representing our country well, but I heard it was not a good day for Sleepy Joe or Crazy Bernie. One is exhausted, the other nuts. So what's the big deal?" So apparently Trump also watched the debate, or at least tweeted about the debate.
I mean, I can't find numbers, but Vox is claiming, you know, who knows how true it is if Vox is claiming it, that it was the highest turnout for a midterm in a long time.
Yeah, I bet it's close. So hopefully we can figure that out. The turnouts are historically low for midterms. So that's why I thought it would be cool to compare that. But
all these articles, I mean, again, you look at deceitfulness, right? All of these articles are in percentages. They're not in actual numbers.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I think
national voter turnout, midterm elections 1978 to 2018, it was higher than every other one in that period. But it says 53.4%, and they're saying this is percentage of the citizen voting age population that voted.
Okay.
So that's if you look at 53.4% of people 18 and above voted in the last election. So how many people in America are 18 and above? You know what I'm saying? Why can't they just tell me that number? This is all percentages. The U.S. Census, this is census.gov, and it's all just percentages.
Oh, that's crazy.
So it's 53.4%. So now I go to Google, American citizens 18 and above. Ladies and gentlemen, this is news coverage. This is news coverage. You have to do research that the journalists won't tell you. Total population by kid and adult populations. Here we go.
Way to step on it, Justin.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for stopping by the Midside this week.
Oh, well, okay. While you research that, why don't we move on to the next story, if my computer will let me. So, Tom Cruise versus Justin Bieber. Fight talks have been held per UFC's Dana White. This comes from Bleacher Report. UFC president Dana White acknowledged on Thursday that he had been involved in discussions regarding a potential fight between actor Tom Cruise and singer Justin Bieber. "It's true," White said at #sports2019. "As crazy as it sounds, that is true. I don't want to use any names, but I was at home on Sunday and I got a call with two big guys on the phone. They were telling me this could possibly happen and it could be real. And I'm like, there's no way that this is really going to happen. But if it does, call me back. I'm in." Back on June 9th, 25-year-old Bieber took to social media to issue a challenge to the 56-year-old Cruise, putting White on notice in the process. Bieber later told TMZ Sports that it wasn't a serious challenge, saying that it was just a random tweet that he had been known to send. He added that Cruise would probably whoop my ass in a fight. "So, Justin, who do you have, the lesbian or the Scientologist?"
Man, Justin Bieber really said that Tom Cruise could beat him up in a fight? I mean, the age gap here is so large, isn't it? Isn't Tom Cruise like 59 at this point?
I think you're not taking into account the testosterone gap, though.
I mean, there is a big testosterone gap in there. I agree with you. But
I mean, they're both short. Cruise is older. Well, that matters in fighting. You know, your height does matter. Your reach matters. Cruz has done a lot of his own stunts, you know, famously climbing the mountain in Mission Impossible 2 and, you know, things like that, right? So, you know, he's probably in decent shape. Bieber's known for, well, I don't know about anything athletic. I think he has those funny videos where his posse is pretending like he actually knows how to play basketball. But outside of that, I haven't really seen him do much athletic things.
Yeah, I just don't know why you're taking this seriously as far as who would win. I mean, do you remember back in the 90s there was a television show on MTV before MTV was total crap, when they were just kind of crap? They had Celebrity Deathmatch, which was like the claymation fights between celebrities. Did you ever see that show?
Yeah.
Yeah, that show was entertaining because it took things like this and it did it in a farcical way, because it was like, this is a joke that we care so much about these celebrity feuds and we make a big deal out of them. Now the fact that this is legitimately being discussed, I mean, isn't this proof of how insane and off the rails we've gone as a culture? Why would anyone care about Justin Bieber fighting Tom Cruise?
I'm less pessimistic than you. I think this is great marketing. I just want to know if this was started by Bieber's people or Justin's people.
You just said the same person twice. You said
Justin's people or Cruise's people. Sorry.
Well, I mean, look, it's more than that. It's Dana White jumping on an opportunity as well to get the name UFC in the news. I mean, Justin Bieber and Tom Cruise start having a social media feud, and then Dana White's like, oh yeah, why don't we have discussions with them, and then we can market it. It's more of the UFC-WWE overlap is what this is. I mean, remember when Brock Lesnar interrupted after the main event and jumped in the octagon and cut a pro wrestling promo, and now he has spurned UFC and gone back to WWE. It's more of the crossover of that.
Yeah,
and that's
I don't follow soap operas, so I don't know any of that.
Well, that's the point I'm making. You know, I don't follow soap operas. That's a great way of putting it. I mean, it's more of the way our entire society has become this way. I mean, sure, if they want to get in there and beat the hell out of each other, but then wasn't there that event too where, remember when Tanya Harding was in that boxing match on television and they tried to do the celebrity fights? And it was just terrible.
Yeah.
It's all the same thing. I just look, if you want to see like Justin Bieber and Tom Cruise in like a rap battle, okay, like Tom Cruise isn't really a musician in the way Justin Bieber is, but at least it's both in their entertainment realm. It's just like, imagine if like Tom Brady and Peyton Manning had a rap battle. Like, I wouldn't care. Would I watch it? Yeah. Just because it's Tom Brady, but I don't care. I don't know, man. This seems like a joke to me. It seems absurd.
Yeah, well, speaking of jokes, young Instagram users open up about online stress. If it gets under 200 likes, I just delete it. While it's easy to joke and deflect your way out of caring about it, Instagram, for some, can prove to be a minefield in terms of general mental wellness. For younger users, this potential for negative impact brought on by near-constant usage is of particular concern at the moment within the national discourse on social media's long-term effects. As it typically annoying as articles sourced from cable news segments purporting to know anything about this demographic are, we'll do our best here to keep the cringe at a tolerable level. So, the quote here from apparently the student Jackson in the 12 to 18 range, if I have a post and it gets under 200 likes, I just delete it. Ever since that's become a trend, people are more gravitated towards to put things on there that they don't want everyone to see. So, Justin, do you delete all your posts that get under 200 likes?
I mean, I would have no social media if I did that. How do you know 200 people for 200 people to like your shit?
I was thinking the same thing. Call me an old fogey, but 200 people would have been literally one third of my high school.
of my high school, my entire school, K through 12, was 500 people.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of, is this social media privilege? Is this big city privilege?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe social media privilege is the way to put it. It's just, what are these standards and why are people caring so much about what's on the internet? The fact that it's a mental health issue and you're deleting your stuff. I've never gotten 200 likes on a post in my life.
Redistribution of likes. I mean, this mental health crisis just won't go away until we redistribute likes.
What does it say about the younger generation that this is what they're concerned with?
I don't want to go there, Justin. I want to go towards the proposed problem here is kids not getting likes causing mental anguish, where the real problem is the school system and this self-esteem movement pointing people at looking at external validation for their self-esteem. Like, this is, I don't blame the kids for this. I blame teachers and the schools and parents for this.
Well, yeah, you're going in the same direction. I mean, kids need to be taught better to be internal about your self-esteem rather than external. I agree completely. It's just at a certain point, this is the tough thing about when you're dealing with kids and the development of kids. At what point do they become responsible for themselves outside of what they've been taught?
And what I mean, according to healthcare regulation, I think it's like 32 or something.
32.
when you're no longer eligible to be on your parents' healthcare.
Okay, that's 32 now. I thought it was 26. It's 32.
Maybe I was listening to the presidential debates and got confused.
Yeah, okay. So 32, 26. So we're saying at that point, you are responsible for yourself. And if you believe something bad, you are then responsible for realizing it's bad and growing past it.
Yeah.
But before that, you're saying that it's not their fault?
I don't want to absolve the Utes of today of their responsibility. I just want to look at the real cause, right? And the reason it's the same issue when we talk about, you know, homeless in LA. It's always high cost of living and housing availability that's causing people to, you know, live in tents in Santa Monica and under the 405. When that's not addressing the real issue of mental health issues and drug abuse, right? Like, we're just, you know, we're not actually looking at the cause. We're looking at a symptom and trying to treat the symptom.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the same thing here that you're pointing out very wisely, that this is a symptom and not the cause. And I agree with you completely about the cause. And that's really the direction I was aiming at, where I'm saying, you know, where is this, you know, what does this say about our youth? Because social media is ultimately a tool and we need to walk it back. And we need to walk it back by realizing this is a way of sharing. It's not a way of gaining. And too many people are using it as a way of gaining self-esteem and gaining importance. And it's just, it's terrifying. An article like this is tragic to read. I mean, did it break your heart to read this article, William? Because, you know, at one point I was confused, but then later on I was like, man, what world are they growing up in that this is important to them? That's sad to me. And I don't mean sad in like, haha, you're a sad person. I mean sad in like, it breaks my heart. It gives me a heavy heart.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really feel that kind of sadness. I think for me, it was a little bit more indignation at this societal pressure on folks to conform and to get that external validation. That just makes me very indignant, because I've never been someone who fits in, quote unquote, like that. And it's been instead of it being something that makes me spiral into depression, it's something that I'm kind of a little bit oddly proud of, right? That I'm independent in that way, that I don't need to get 200 likes on Instagram to be able to sleep at night.
Well, I think that is why you fit in the Midside, because I think what you just described is what the Midside is about. It's being proud of being an individual, and it just so happens that we, each of us, you know, myself, you, Daniel, are individuals in a way that really draws attention to the fact of the importance of individuality. We don't do it intentionally, right? I mean, you weren't intentionally, like, you weren't like, man, I'm going to be gay and I'm going to be a gay person.
Yeah, who's I'm not a hipster, right? Like, I'm not, right. Oh, I'm going to be different just like all my friends.
Right, exactly. But you happen to be a gay man who just isn't like other gay men. So it really draws attention to individuality when someone talks to you or someone is friends with you or someone learns about you. It makes them really confront things about themselves. Like, I can't imagine what it's like to be like a stereotypical gay male who's obsessed with fitting in and then to meet someone like you
because you don't fit those stereotypes. That's for sure.
It's going to be uncomfortable for them. But likewise, for myself, like, I don't intentionally like the things I like to be different or be, you know, contrarian. To draw ire to myself, to be contrarian. But for some reason, it just happens. Like, I literally was born into a family that supports the Patriots. And then it happened to be that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick are these morally upstanding and amazing people. So I started following them, and then everyone hates them.
Don't they also support the patriarchy?
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And then the same thing when you look at Zack Snyder. It's like, I didn't intentionally find a filmmaker who people think supports the patriarchy and is sexist and racist and everything. And white supremacist, probably. I mean, they haven't said that. No, they've said that before because all of his leads are like white males, straight white males. I didn't intentionally find that, but I seem to have become contrarian because of that. Even, you know, the music we listen to, William. I mean, wasn't it linked to incels recently, pop punk?
Yeah, so, oddly. It seems really odd. A little bit of a stretch, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, how do you sing about girls if you haven't had sex with them? Yeah, I mean. But that's what that's their argument about the genre. But the point I'm making is, I think that's a lot of what the Midside is we happen to be very stark individuals that, unfortunately, are opposite the culture, not by intention. It's not a second-handed hipster thing. So we stand in opposition to that, and it makes people confront individuality. And I think that's a lot of the value of the show. And I think that's why a news story like this is so important to us. Because for me, I don't know, William, I don't know about you with social media, but I think we come up with pretty good content. I think when I actually do post things on like Instagram stories, I think I come up with good content. And I've had maybe like, I think the most views I've ever had on an Instagram story is like 36. So I don't understand how 200, less than 200 makes these kids upset. And I also don't understand how what they're doing gets that much attention. But I guess it's the whole Marvel thing. It's the whole McDonald's thing. If you're going for the aggregate, you just make it as generic as possible. And then generic people, there are more of them, so they'll watch it more.
I have the answer, Justin. It's Russian bots. Russian bots.
William, my degree from FU says you are 100% correct.
It's Russian bots.
I don't even remember saying that drop. No, you're right, dude. For a while, straight up, I had like, they had to have been, I was joking, but they had to have been Russian bots. There was this Russian couple that each of them would look at my stories, the Midside stories on Instagram. And it was a Russian girl who claimed to be a model and then a photographer who supposedly was a guy, Russian photographer, who was her boyfriend. And each account would look at my stories for a while. They had to have been Russian bots, didn't they?
I guess. Well, just to put a bow on this. So we talked about this, like, gaining validation as self-esteem. And I think this is one side of a coin. And the other side of that coin is this, is the, that thing about social justice that says we have to have someone just like you in order for you to identify with things, to identify with art or film, movies, everything. You know, if you are a one-armed lesbian veteran, if there's no mainstream superheroes that are one-armed lesbian veterans, then you can't get anything out of the art. And I think it's just something that's been bubbling around in my head since reading the story, that these are two sides of the same coin, right? Like, the independence in me that makes me not give two shits about how many likes I get on a Instagram post is the same independence that I can look at characters who are nothing like me at art and draw from their values and form a real connection to the art. And to me, this is the same sort of like NPC mentality that really unites these two thoughts. And I think they're really the same, the lack of independence.
Well, yeah. And the thing that's interesting about what you point out is it's really a surface level way of looking at, and I'm sure we've said this before on the show, but it's a surface level way of looking at what makes you similar to a person. Notice how all the things we named when we talked about it were value-based. They were idea-based. Even with what you just said, you talked about values in it. Whereas all of these people are looking at just surface level things, right? Race, gender, sexuality, age. All of these things are just very surface level.
Well, I agree. So let's move on to the last story, which I'm sure
we
will have
every story like that from now on. Well, I agree. Let's move on. That's very
I'm sure we'll have nothing to say about this headline from Cosmo. I've cheated on every boyfriend I've ever had, and I don't regret it. If you're in your early 20s, you shouldn't either. By a anonymous hero.
Can I just stop you right there?
Sure.
Can I just stop you right there? Because this is completely relevant to what I was saying about the Antifa story. I know you're going to pull out some quotes, and I think they're important to hear. But this is the same thing as the Antifa story. If you don't regret it, and you don't think you did anything wrong, you wouldn't need to be posting this anonymously. You would share who you actually were. But the fact that whoever this person is, if it's even real, because if it's anonymous, we don't even know if it's real. But let's just say it's real.
Are you impugning the journalistic integrity of Cosmopolitan magazine?
I don't think I need to impugn it. I think it just everyone impugns it automatically. But yes, I am.
All right. Continue.
So let's grant that it's real, though. OK, let's grant that it's real. If this is real and if you really weren't ashamed of it, you wouldn't need to share it anonymously. You would put your name because you would say this is a real, legitimate thing people need to read, to understand, to learn. It's like it's not like I post a movie review and I'm so ashamed of it that I go post it by anonymous. I post a review and I say, I wrote this because these are the ideas I want you to take from it, and these are the life lessons I think that you can learn from it.
Yeah. Well, let's get into those quotes here because they're hilarious. So first we have to set the table. We were sitting close enough together on the edge of his bed that I thought I could feel the heat of his body without actually touching him. A nervous magnetism was keeping us closer together than necessary, also just slightly apart. If energy and air were visible, the inches between our respective thighs would have been flashing neon. The charge came from a tenuous, unspoken sexual attraction that was the entire basis of our, quote, friendship, quote, one that we've never actually acknowledged because I was, at the time, in a serious relationship. My boyfriend, we'll say his name is Matt, was a mutual friend. I'd come over to Drew's place that night in early summer under some ridiculous guise that I can't even remember now. But it had worked. So there we were, thighs squishing against the sagging side of the bed, waiting for either something to happen or nothing. Before you hate me for what comes next, you should know something. I hadn't felt my body heat up like that in months. Matt and I had sex every day, sometimes multiple times a day, for the first 2 years of a relationship. But that humid night in early June, we'd stopped. Not entirely, but enough so that he could look at me before we fall asleep and tell me the exact number of days it had been since we'd fucked. I was 21, so when I started feeling an aversion to having sex with my boyfriend, I thought, these are my horniest years. Something must be wrong with me. I considered seeing a therapist to try and fix myself. It hadn't yet occurred to me that maybe I didn't want to have sex with my boyfriend because of who he was. The way he kept track of the days since we last had sex felt more like a threat than a concern. Here's another great quote. So, she goes on and just completely rationalizes, all of this, cheating. And then, at the end, she says, sometimes you know something is a bad idea and that's why you do it. So Justin, what kind of person knows something is a bad idea and purposely does it because it's a bad idea?
someone who wants to be a victim. Someone who believes life is suffering and wants to be seen as being a victim and being unable to be happy. Because ultimately, this goes back to the self-esteem thing you were talking about. Someone who does not want to be responsible for her own morality. Her morality being taking control of her own life and being the best version that she can be. Because if the only way she can have any happiness or pleasure is to be deceitful because the world is messed up, then she has taken responsibility away from herself. I mean, this reminds me of, and I've always hated this fucking, this meme has been on the internet for a while. There's some things on the internet that I really fucking have hated that have been around from the beginning. So since the beginning of Facebook profiles, girls have always put up like the Marilyn Monroe quotes or the Sex and the City quote about how, oh, maybe some women just aren't meant to be tamed. And just that, those are really annoying. But then there's also the one, have you seen this one, William, about like your best friend isn't the person who tells you to not do a bad thing. They're the person who's wakes up in jail with you the next morning.
Ugh.
I hate that because this is exactly what you're talking about. No, my best friend would tell me what's right and what's wrong and encourage me to do the right thing and continue to be my friend if I did the right thing and want to be less of my friend if I did the wrong thing. Because they don't want bad people in their life, and they want me to be happy. Yeah. They don't want to see me go to jail. The idea that your best friend is the person who encourages you to be self-destructive is insane. It's insane, and this is a perfect example of this.
Yeah, I think it's particularly disturbing when you identify that something must be wrong with the relationship, so I could go to therapy, or I can just fuck my boyfriend's friend. Like, which is the more destructive move, right? Even just, like, ending the relationship, or, you know, backing off the relationship, or whatever would be the proper step to do there. But instead, let's fuck up, like, multiple relationships simultaneously.
Well, and fuck up your own psychology, because you're saying this is okay. I mean, even look how the story is framed. Oh, we came over, or I came over under some reason, right? What was the phrasing that was used? Some cover story?
Some
what was
pretense,
the
yeah.
Pretense, there we go, pretense, right? Some pretense. Why do you need a pretense to go over to somebody's house that you're attracted to and you want to be with? Why can't you just say, I want to go over because I want to spend time with someone I find attractive? Why do you need a pretense? But again, this is something that's taught from the time you're young as a kid. I know that I was taught this, and I had internalized it without realizing it, and this is especially destructive as a guy, that you can't just straight out say you like a girl and say you're attracted to her. You have to come up with excuses to spend time with them. You can't just say, I like you, so I want to do these things with you. You have to say, I want to do these things with you, and then sneak in the idea when you're spending time with them that you're attracted to them. It's the whole idea of, again, this is a self-esteem thing. You can't do things directly. It's all smuggled in there from the beginning.
And also imagine having such little trust in your partner that when you start having these feelings that, and you stop having sex with your partner and your partner says, hey, what's up? You know, like, especially for a guy, like, sex is important. Like, this is a, you know, this indicates a problem, right? And your solution is, well, I'll go have sex with this other person, right? Like, how dare he be concerned that we're not having as much sex? Oh, he's counting it. It's like, what is that? Like, isn't that an indicator that something's going wrong? If you're not feeling into the sex and he's like, what the fuck? Why aren't we having sex? It seems like a conversation would be in order, not someone else's penis.
Yeah, I mean, not to like completely rake the girl over the coals and let the guy get off scot-free here, because why is he hanging out around in this relationship where he's counting the days and she's not even responding to him, right? And at the other hand, you know, again, this is all from her point of view. But let's grant that. Let's assume he hasn't communicated this well. He's got to improve his communication as well. I mean, counting the days can come across very passive aggressive, right? Couldn't
yeah,
have just said,
absolutely.
You know, I'm concerned that, you know, we haven't had sex in a while, and that's important to me, and I feel the intimacy is lacking. Hopefully he would have the maturity to say that. Maybe he has, because, you know, she needs to make him look bad in order to rationalize her cheating. But the point is, all of this is so, this relationship is so broken that the answer would be, if you want to go do this, that's fine. No one's saying, like, don't go have sex with other people, but don't be with the person you're still with that you're not having sex with.
Don't be dishonest about it.
It's not just dishonest. It's backwards, William. She's in a committed relationship with someone she doesn't want to have sex with, and then she's not committed to the people she does want to have sex with. It's completely backwards.
Yeah.
It's just, is there anything else to say?
I don't think so.
All right. So speaking of being backwards, I have a movie review to talk about this week that actually I'm interested in what you have to say about what I have to say, William. So let's go into it in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. If you haven't yet joined our Discord channel, you should do that. One of the trailers we talk about this week was actually submitted to us through Discord in the Patreon-only channel. Discord's a great place to share conversation with us. I know Midsider Frank had a great take on the last news story. And I'll just mean the last, I mean the literal last one, even though it was also the last one we talked about. So you can get in there and join the conversation. You can also see other news stories that people share and we share that don't necessarily make the cut. I know right now I'm looking at William has a tweet up about Andy Ngo's brain damage that's in Discord. So there's a lot more of the evidence of what we're talking about as well to let you know we're fact checking. So go ahead to our midside.com/podcast and join our Discord. So William, this week I saw the movie yesterday, and I don't remember when we were doing Trailer Takedown. Did you hug or tackle it?
I believe I tackled it.
Okay, what was the reason you tackled it? Do you remember?
I remember sitting on the fence about it. I was like, why not just listen to the album? It seemed like a copycat of Bohemian Rhapsody, which I enjoyed, but it wasn't a particularly good movie.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even compare this to Bohemian Rhapsody on any level. So this is directed by Danny Boyle, who won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire. He also did 28 Days and 28 Weeks Later. So he has a history of being successful. This is a movie about a guy who there's a 12-second blackout throughout the world. And during that blackout, he gets hit by a bus and he wakes up and he's the only person who remembers the Beatles. So he starts saying he wrote the Beatles songs and he becomes world famous for it. Now, that premise, William, what kind of stuff do you think they would go into? If you're looking at it from, like, let's look at it from a science fiction perspective. What kind of stuff do you think they would go into?
Well, I would hope it would go into the psychology of stealing someone else's credit and how that can, you know, damage your connection to reality, where you start thinking you're the genius when really you're not, and that kind of guilt and what that would have, what kind of destruction that would have on your psychology.
Okay, so it kind of goes into the guilt, but not really. That is a plot point at the end, but there's none of this destruction of his own psychology. He knows he didn't write the songs the whole time. What about, though, what I'm also talking about, William, is wouldn't you want to know why the blackout happened and what other things people may or may not have forgotten, or if he's the only one who remembers the Beatles?
Yeah. I think you would expect there to be some sort of twist involving, like, someone or something that caused it, and him having to prevent the undoing of that thing, right? Because he's got all this fame and money now that because of this item, and then maybe even using it for causing other things to be forgotten.
Right, exactly. Instead, there are just a few little jokes throughout the movie, like one time he tries to order a Coke and people think he wants cocaine because only Pepsi exists. And then there's another time where like cigarettes don't exist. So they don't go into that at all. They even set up something at the beginning of the movie. It's shown that his manager, who's also the woman who he loves, and that's a big story in the movie, fell in love with him because she saw him playing Oasis Wonderwall at the middle school talent show. And at one point he learns that Oasis didn't exist in this world either. They never even addressed that. Like, wouldn't you expect him to have a conversation to be like, do you remember, you know, that talent show? What song did I play? Because she doesn't remember the Beatles. Does she remember Oasis? They never have that conversation. Isn't that like a basic thing you would expect if that's set up?
Wait, you expect that setups have payoffs in today's culture?
Okay, well, that's you understand what I'm building towards then. I will say, though, that, and this is a major spoiler, so if you care to be spoiled about this terrible movie, then turn off now.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
But who cares? So you know how you said you expected there to be a person or something that's different?
Yeah, yeah.
So the person that's different is John Lennon didn't die because he wasn't famous, so nobody murdered him. So this guy goes and he finds John Lennon, and John Lennon's been living a completely normal life. And it's about, and John Lennon tells him how it's important to live a normal life. So the title of the movie Yesterday is about how this guy's famous, but he yearns for yesterday when he wasn't famous anymore. So it becomes a whole movie about how being normal is good, but it's not about how being normal is good, because if that's the best of your ability, then you're trying your hardest and there's nothing wrong with being normal. It's a movie about how even if you have ability, it's better to be normal. I mean, think about it. John Lennon exists in this world and he never became famous, but he says what's better because, you know, he's not dead, right? Because the
main character is like a dentist or something.
Is he a dentist?
Yeah, John Lennon, the alive John Lennon.
No, he's even worse than that. He lives out on the coast somewhere, out away from everyone. And he's all alone, and he's almost like a hermit.
So he's living his best life, question mark?
Right, that's the point. And his best life is because he didn't get assassinated. Because being in the Beatles led to him getting assassinated, which isn't good, obviously. But because of that, they're saying, well, the alternative is he would ever was famous, so he was able to live peacefully and meet the woman he loves and fall in love and live a great life with her all on their own.
So the theme is be normal and also a hermit.
Right. Be normal, but normal as opposed to ability, because ability is a burden and greatness is a burden. That's what it's saying, if you're going to be generous towards it or not. But the point is, this is like, how could they couldn't have mined this premise worse. If you want to see how naturalism is done, how you can take a great premise and make it naturalistic, this is how you do it. I was bored through most of this movie. I was sitting there, I was like, this is so boring. There was no depth to it. And that's the interesting thing to me, William. And this is the last thing I'll say about this, and maybe you have something to say about it as well. It's so interesting to me that people think naturalism is the more intelligent way to do storytelling and art and filmmaking, when it so obviously has a lack of depth. Like the way you described, you know, the psychological effects on this guy of, you know, feeling guilty and he becomes disconnected from reality for making art and claiming it's his that's not really his, has much more depth than was actually executed. But someone who makes a film like this and makes this naturalism thinks they are being much more intelligent and thinks they are having much more depth. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that fascinating?
I mean, it would be, right? It sounds like we see this happen a lot, right? When you try to do sci-fi naturalistically, it just doesn't work. Like the whole part of changing reality and seeing what the consequences are, the way you do that is you have to extract some sort of like general thing about humanity in order for that to work, even in the most fantastical sci-fi, that's what makes it good sci-fi, is that you're actually talking about humanity, real people, making decisions and the consequences of those decisions.
Right, exactly. And I think what you said applies to Game of Thrones as well. And we talked about that on the Patreon exclusive episode. And last thing here, I think related to what you just said, is he does make a choice in this movie. At the end of the movie, he chooses to release all the songs he recorded for free and then not be famous anymore. He just says, I don't want to do this. Here's all the songs for free. I don't want to make money off of them. Here they are. The world deserves this great art. I don't deserve to make money for it because I didn't make it. There you go. So it is about his choice. But it's not really a choice at that point, because the whole movie he's just been reacting and these things have just been happening to him. And there hasn't been any real establishing of the world and the people and the real consequences of it. So even though it's naturalistic, there's nothing real about the consequences, because it's usually boiled down to one choice rather than showing the choices throughout.
Hmm.
Which is, you would say that's the same thing with Game of Thrones,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think early, the thing with Game of Thrones, and shameless plug, if you subscribe to Patreon, you get access to our exclusive Patreon only Game of Thrones analysis. You know, the choices matter early on in Game of Thrones, but then the choices don't matter in the later seasons, right? You have, and then when you put those together, it becomes completely naturalistic.
Yeah, you're nicer to me. I think it was the illusion of choice early on. You're nicer than me. I think it was the illusion of choice early on, but
yeah,
minor quibble. But the point is, it's interesting that, you know, I'm just pointing out that we live in a mixed society, and it's not always purely naturalistic and purely romantic. It generally isn't. These places are generally mixed, and people, I think, get disillusioned because they see choice. Like when you see Tony Stark choose to snap his fingers in Endgame and sacrifice himself, people say, "Oh, well, that's romantic." Well, no, it's not, because everything in it that led up to that choice is naturalism sets up the choice, and then it's a romantic choice. And that might be even worse than naturalism. The idea of romanticizing naturalism is kind of even scarier in itself. And that's the thing I have to think about more, but all of these movies aren't generally one or the other, and I don't want to make it seem that way. So,
yeah. So you should see this if
you like terrible movies. I mean, if you look, you could see this as intellectual curiosity, right? If you want to see what I'm talking about, if you want to observe all of the things I just talked about, then see this movie. But you shouldn't see this movie if you don't want to be bored. It's just, there are better movies to see.
All right.
And look, I want to be clear. This isn't as bad as Booksmart. If somebody made me, this Booksmart is my new benchmark standard for a terrible movie. If somebody made me choose between this movie and Booksmart, I would still see this movie. All right, let's move on to Trailer Takedown. As always, the trailers are posted on the websites on Saturdays. So if you want to watch those trailers before the episode, during the episode, after the episode, you can do that at themidside.com/podcast.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
His Dark Materials is an upcoming HBO TV show starring James McAvoy. This trailer was submitted to us by a Midsider in the Patreon only chat. I'm trying to pull it up right now to see the name of the person, but I had it closed, William. That's why. So this was submitted to us by, it's so hard to navigate this. Dark Waltz 75 submitted this trailer. This trailer reminded me of sort of, remember the Big Friendly Giant, William, where they were like, the giants wanted to like take kids and use them.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what was happening in this trailer, but it seemed like they were using the kids' nightmares against the world. This looks really interesting. James McAvoy is sort of becoming like John Hamm to me, where it seems like he always picks good projects. It's like he never makes a bad career choice as far as, you know, what makes good art and what doesn't. So I'm going to give this a chance. I'll probably watch a couple episodes of this. This is, for me, this is a hug.
Hug.
Yeah, so it looks like it's got good production value. I have read these books, and they were okay. decent sci-fi, sci-fi fantasy, I would say. So,
are the books about?
Hard to say without spoiling things, but basically it's like a multiverse, and there's a mystery about this particle called dust. And there's a little bit of, like you were saying, that was hinted at the trailer, that there's something about children and these children in particular that make that important. So it's sort of unraveling that mystery is the point of the story. So,
well, that description makes me more likely to see it.
Yeah,
so.
I'm very optimistic, so I'm going to give this a hug.
Hug! Second trailer.
Abominable is the latest from the DreamWorks team that brought you How to Train Your Dragon. It's about this little girl that befriends an abominable monster that needs to go home. I mean, this seems like exactly the same thing as How to Train Your Dragon, except it's got Asians in it. Right? Am I wrong? That's what it looks like here?
Yeah, it does.
It looks exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
So there's two things with that, right? The first thing is, stop making movies with Asians. Because Crazy Rich Asians got popular, so now you're going to do this. So everything's going to have Asians in it now. But the second thing is, you know they're not going to stop because most movies nowadays, I think, are made for the Chinese market and not for the American market. I think this is a movie exactly like this. But what's really interesting to me is they're using American resources and American freedom to get Chinese money. Because why don't you just make these movies in Chinese? No, they make them in English and then translate them to Chinese. I'm getting way too cynical about this. I'm not going to see this. I wanted Daniel to comment on this, but for me, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen this movie before, and I'm not a huge fan of the DreamWorks animation. But really, you say it's like How to Train a Dragon. I feel like I've seen Snowman movies like this before. Like, why can't we do something original? Tackle.
Third trailer.
The Peanut Butter Falcon is about a young man with Down syndrome who wants to be a professional wrestler. And I think he runs away from home and runs into Shia LaBeouf, who helps him like experience the world. There's sort of parallels here or echoes here of Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, where they're going to go on like a raft on the river to get to the pro wrestling school. This young man wants to join, and he calls himself the Peanut Butter Falcon. But there's something very confusing about this trailer. What's very confusing about this trailer is I legitimately like the content of this story. I like the idea that there's someone with Down syndrome who wants to be this idealized version of himself, this professional wrestler, and he wants to chase the dream even though he's being told not to by his sister, who just wants to protect him and keep him in this infantile state. And I think using a person with Down syndrome to tell that story is phenomenal, because if a person with Down syndrome can do it, anyone else can do it too. So I think there's a lot of great elements there. I love the use of Shia LaBeouf. I think this is the kind of role that he could do. He's very funny, and he has a likability to him. This, you know, I've liked him since Even Stevens. And I think in this kind of role, he can really excel, especially in a comedic type role. But the aesthetic of this movie seems to be very naturalistic, and that worries me. So I'm very torn on this movie. But at the same time, I just don't think I don't know how they can do this and end this with a naturalistic message, unless the main character with Down syndrome dies tragically. And that would be my biggest fear of this, that ultimately it's about Shia LaBeouf and the sister falling in love, and because of that, the kid with Down syndrome has to die. And that worries me. But I'm going to give this a very, very tentative hug.
Hug?
Yeah, I think for once I'm more cynical than you. He will not divide us, Shia LaBeouf. I can't see, just from the preview and the way this is shot, this ending any other way except for terribly. And I think that tension of this could go somewhere and then disappointing at the end. I just don't want to risk it. So I'm going to wait till you watch it and tell me if it's suitable for my eyes. But for now, I'll just keep memeing on Shia LaBeouf and Tackle.
Tackle?
So, William, then, I have to ask you, usually you spoil the movies. Do you think I just spoiled the ending?
I think you might have, and because I was thinking the same thing, and you went there first. So, okay. Yeah, I think there's some sort of tragedy that will happen at the end, which will prove that life is meaningless, ambition is futile, blah, blah, blah.
Right, and, you know, they'll get on the raft, and he'll die somehow in the river or something. And then the sister will be like, see, I was right. You couldn't just let me protect him. And it'll be about how terrible Shia LaBeouf is and how this guy's life, if we had just kept this kid with Down syndrome in captivity, he could have been able to live. Just like the John Lennon thing, right?
Yeah.
Even though John Lennon lived a great life, because he died, it was a tragic life. So he's supposed to be less to live longer. It's they wanted about the number of years in your life, not the amount of life in your years.
Yeah. Yep.
Final trailer.
The Current War is a movie starring a bunch of people who have been superheroes about Thomas Edison versus Nikola Tesla. William, here's the problem I'm having with this trailer. This trailer is so bad, I don't even want to go into describing all of this.
Oh, but you have to because it's hilarious.
Look, I like Michael Shannon, okay? And Michael Shannon's in this. I like Benedict Cumberbatch. Then randomly Tom Holland's in it. And then I don't even remember. Who's the fourth person that's been in a superhero movie that's in this? Oh, Nicholas Holt, right? So it's those four people who are all good actors, right? You can't really fault anyone except I don't know about Tom Holland. But just because he's Spider-Man, he gets all these roles. And in it, Thomas Edison, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, is feuding with Nikola Tesla, played by Nicholas Holt, over the future of electricity. And Tesla seems to think that if Edison is successful instead of him, the world will be set back years, which, I mean, I think that implies that we've been set back years.
Tesla won. AC current won.
Okay, well, so I don't even know enough about this. But also, the whole title, The Current War, like, there better be some goddamn parallels to current reality and current society for calling this the current war. That's too sophisticated for this. Maybe you need to talk about this some more. I've never seen a trailer with so many good actors in it look so absolutely terrible, especially with a trailer that is about something that should be interesting, Edison and Tesla. Look, if you want to watch this movie, just fucking go watch The Prestige, all right? That has this already in all this shit. Tackle.
This should be an interesting story. This is the worst, most cliched trailer. Like, it's like they took the success from Imitation Game and was like, quick, find another true story, and then let's put the heartbeat tension music and make it, like, super over the top. And it's... is this for the Chinese audience too? Like, this can't possibly be, right? Like, who is supposed to see this movie?
Which I don't know who could this be is for, super who interesting. Is this for?
I don't know. It's like the trailer is cut like it's a suspense thriller, right? Like, maybe there's aliens involved or something, right? But this is
interdimensional aliens?
I don't know. I can't believe that, I hope this movie is better, but judging by the trailer, which is what we have to do, there's no way that this is good. So, Tackle.
I think it's worse than the Dictionary movie trailer.
Is it worse than Clue? The Clue trailer?
I was referring to the one recently. Remember the origin story of the Dictionary?
Oh, yeah.
Terribly cliche. Well, let's just end this episode, huh?
All right.
What did we learn this trip, William?
Well, I learned that cement milkshakes are just peaceful protest. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that there's a such thing as cement milkshakes. I didn't even know that Antifa's doing that. That's terrifying.
I bet someone had a flavor called cement mixer or something. Like, isn't there like a drink, an alcohol drink called cement? So someone out there had a milkshake called the cement mixer, I'm sure, and now they're gonna have to take it off the market as hate speech.
No, it's not hate speech. It's love speech, because it's being used against
fascists.
Oh, that's
right. Peaceful protest. I forgot what I had already learned this trip.
I mean, look, can I just, like, name my, like, can I just make a group and name it, like, fuck hate, and then I can just be go around and be hateful to people? Like, that's what they've done, right? We're Antifa, therefore anything
we're
we do
anti-fascist,
is anti-fascist.
So therefore we can behave exactly like fascists.
Look. This is something the left has done my entire life, and I don't know how no one has figured it out yet. I figured it out when I was young. I figured it out in, like, high school. The left says one thing to allow themselves to get away with anything. It's like in Lost when Michael was like, we're the good guys, Michael. They just say they're the good guys, and then they think they can do whatever they want because they've convinced people they're the good guys.
Yeah, well, we're the good guys, so make sure that you support us.
I wouldn't even claim that. This is where, now you went there, and I'm going to go.
Oh, no.
To the Batman versus Superman reference. Maybe he's not a Jesus or a devil character. Maybe he's just a guy trying to do the right thing. Just a guy trying to do the right thing, William. I wouldn't say I'm good or bad, I just am.
The perfect false dichotomy, bro, right? We're just here trying to do the right thing.
Well, that's the answer to the false dichotomy, bro. The false dichotomy is you're either good or bad.
Yeah. Well, if you're either good or bad, you too can support the show on patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon. Make sure to check out our Discord server. You can see the link on themidside.com at the end of every episode, and there's links to the stories so you can dig in. And don't forget the Midside store. You can pick up your Hail Snydra shirt and various other merchandise. And make sure you tell a friend. Share the show on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And don't delete it if it gets less than 200 likes. Just keep it up there. We'll add all the likes together. I'm sure we'll get more than 200 likes.
Meh. Don't care. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Amosneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
I am still privileged in some way.